This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Come join me, Andrew Filippone.
And me, Patrick Peterson, three-time NFL All-Pro cornerback on First and Pod for premier NFL coverage and conversations.
Our motto on the podcast is every team, every week, and we don't play favorites. Every episode, you get a glimpse of the entire National Football League with First and Pod. Follow and listen to First and Pod on Mondays and Fridays on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
America's favorite place to watch football is Stadium Swim, located at Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas. Catch all the biggest games at a viewing experience built for sports fans. Chill in one of their six pools on three different levels for a perfect view of their massive screen. Plenty of seating options from cozy day beds to private, temperature-controlled cabanas. Stadium Swim. Book your spot today at CircaLasVegas.com.
This is John Lyons right now on WEEI.
Welcome in to WEEI at night. I'm John Lyons alongside the one, the only, Chris Scheim. Chris, how are you tonight?
Lyons, what's up, bud? Long time no talk.
Yeah, it's been, 48 hours, 72 hours? I don't know. Usually it's KJ Carson. He is off tonight. And like I said, I have the pleasure, dare I say the honor, of being joined by maybe the number one Drake May fan in New England, Chris Scheim. And that's where we're going to start. You just heard the audio of Drake May, I think, doing a great job taking accountability for some of his mistakes on Sunday, including that last interception, which I know, Scheim, you've talked about this on the Greg Hill Show and others have talked about it. Maybe it was a Drake May mistake, but not totally Drake May. So let's just start there, Scheim. You heard that cut, that audio. What do you make of Drake May kind of accepting that responsibility on himself?
Yeah, I think as a leader of this football team and like the starting quarterback of a franchise and, you know, hopefully the franchise's hope going forward, it's the right move to take responsibility for that. And he does deserve some blame. Like, that's a risk I felt like he didn't need to take. I heard Tommy Curran say earlier on Jones and Keefe that, like, you know, you stink. That's fine. I don't mind you taking the shot. And I get it. I understand that, but again, like, it was just, I felt like he wanted it all in an overtime drive where you still had over 2 minutes on the clock. Like, you had plenty of time to work your way down the field. You have orchestrated multiple two-minute drives at this point, so I felt like that was a risk that was unnecessary. Do I think that the play could have gone a little bit better? Yeah, I also don't think it was entirely his fault. Again, Kendrick Bourne fell on that corner route that would have held the safety a little bit. If that safety flips his hips to cover Kendrick Bourne, there's zero interception there, and that might be a touchdown, and the game might be won. And so, like, that, I get it. I understand his thought process there. It's not like a stupid mistake. It wasn't one of those Bailey Zappi, let's throw it into double coverage and see what happens picks. It was a logical error that was made, and I respect the fact, though, that he's willing to stand up and take the blame for it.
Yeah, it's nice to have a quarterback that doesn't say, oh, it was bad and stuff anymore right now. I'm just sorry. That was a gratuitous shot right there. But look, he had three turnovers in this game, the two interceptions, the strip sack fumble. And this was something, when he was coming out of college, a lot of the comparisons were to Josh Allen, right? He could be a Josh Allen in the future. And that, to me, up until this season, has been the biggest flaw in Josh Allen's game. He turns the ball over too much. And we saw May in his first start against Houston throw those couple interceptions, have multiple turnovers. And that was something he really cleaned up against Jacksonville and, of course, in the limited time against the Jets. And we saw it come back again against Tennessee. I do put the strip sack fumble a little bit more on him than his O-line. I thought he held onto the ball a little bit too long there. The other interception I thought was a really bad decision, the one over the middle in the first half. And this last one, I think you're right, Scheim, about Kendrick Bourne falling down. And if he doesn't fall down, maybe that other safety is just not there to begin with. But I do think May could have stepped into that throw more, and he underthrew it. So these, to me, are mistakes that he can learn from, though. So I don't want to be all doom and gloom. He is a rookie. We've talked many times already this year that there's going to be growing pains, but we just, to me, I don't want to see these types of mistakes get repeated down the line.
Yeah, and I get that. And it's also hard to say that that ball was underthrown when he put it, you know, 60 yards on a rope. And right, like he was, I understand that you can try and lead Booty even more towards the end zone, but to ask a guy to put a ball, you know, 75 yards in the air down the field, sure, seems a little unfair. So I totally get him flattening out the route there and still taking Booty away from the guy that was assigned coverage on him. And so, you know, like it's, I understood his thought process there. I recognized it. I felt like the interception that was dropped on the pass along the sideline,
yeah,
earlier in the game,
that he couldn't decide whether it was a back shoulder or not. Yeah.
Yeah, that Schlereth pointed that out in the middle of the game. Like, that to me was a far worse throw than that game-losing interception.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I mean, Pro Football Focus, if you buy into that, folks, they had him down for 4 turnover-worthy plays, which I thought was reasonable because it was the 2 interceptions. Obviously, you mentioned that pass there. And what I found interesting about that is you saw after that play Kendrick Bourne kind of throw his hands up and look to the sideline, and I don't know if there was some miscommunication with the play call or between May and Bourne or what happened there. So that's why when I hear May after the game and then in subsequent interviews and then of course on WEEI say, you know, hey, it's I got to make a better decision there. I got to make a better throw there. I think it's nice to see because this is a team. There's a lot of young pieces. Some of the veteran pieces that we thought were going to be leaders are either not here or they're injured or, in Jacoby Brissett's case, have been benched. So it's nice to see him kind of try to grab that mantle of leadership, even if you and I can debate, hey, was that last interception more on him, more on Bourne falling down, whatever. I think the fact that he takes that leadership mantle is an important thing for this team going forward.
100%, right? You are going to look for accountability from your star player. And if that guy is providing you accountability, then everyone else on the team needs to provide themselves accountability. And I think that's kind of what he's doing here, right? He's setting the example. And I've said it now for a few weeks. It's kind of unfortunate and almost sad at times that it seems like one of the most mature players on this Patriots team is a 22-year-old rookie in Drake May.
Yeah, and it's a great point. And I think, though, as they go to build forward, that's something that you want to see from him, right? You want
Absolutely.
That guy to grab that leadership mantle, as I mentioned before, because it felt like, I mean, with Cam Newton, he was a veteran, he was a former MVP, and he was well-respected, but you also could see the diminished physical skills that year. And then Mac Jones come in as a rookie. He really wasn't a leader, and he never grew into it. He wasn't necessarily a detriment to the locker room his rookie year, but he wasn't a leader. Then by the second year, he's having those temper tantrums on the field about Matt Patricia's play calls, which I understand your frustration, man, but the temper tantrums are a little over the top. Zappe was never in a position to maybe be a leader because he was really the backup and the just guy that wasn't Mac Jones for part of the time. But May is in a position to be a leader. It feels like he's taking on that leadership role. And I think, again, it's something for the younger players, especially like a Jalen Polk can look at that, a Kayshon Booty can look at that, even a Mike Onwenu, who I know is older than him, but it's a guy that signed for multiple years and should be a key piece on that offense. They can look at him and say, this is a guy that we can follow. And it feels to me, Shyam, like not only do his teammates see those leadership skills in him, but they are starting to see some of those physical traits that they're really excited about.
Yeah, I think you're starting to see both really start to take shape here. And that the physical stuff is just awesome. I mean, you saw what he did. Accounting for, all but 14 or 15 of their total yards on offense on Sunday.
That's
is
a big problem, though, by the way.
Yeah, I totally agree. It is something that shouldn't happen, and that's why it's only happened twice all year where a quarterback throws for 200 yards and rushes for 90-plus yards. That would be Lamar Jackson and Drake May, both of which did it in a loss, by the way. Lamar Jackson did it on opening night against the Chiefs, and Drake May did it on Sunday against the Titans. Like, that's not a recipe for success. You've seen, like, if you look at Lamar Jackson as that example, right? What have they done since that point? They've relied more on Derrick Henry to balance out that rushing attack and taken some off of Lamar's plate and had him focus on throwing the football. And ultimately, that's what you want the Patriots to do with Drake May. Unfortunately, they're averaging, like, 2.1 yards per carry over the last 2 weeks, which is horrendously bad. The Las Vegas Raiders, according to Austin Gale, have the worst rushing offense by EPA since the turn of the century. And yet somehow, some way over the last 2 weeks, your New England Patriots rushing offense has been worse. The only reason the EPA doesn't balance out that way is because Drake May has been so good at running the football. But your running backs have been horrendous, and they need to be better in order for this offense to start taking its steps forward.
Yeah, and you bring up an interesting point, because the rushing totals, like if you just looked at the totals for this game, well, the Patriots ran for 110 yards, but 95 of them were on Drake May scrambles. And that's the thing. They're not even designed runs.
He could have had another 45 or 50 yards that got called back for penalties.
Yeah, and this, and we, I feel like we've been talking since August, July, maybe June about this offensive line and our concerns. I mean, you look at some of these numbers. Shine, they're averaging fewer than 4 yards per carry running behind every offensive lineman except the right tackle this season. I mean, we're talking 2.1 yards per carry running behind the right guard, 3.4 the left guard, and even some of that is a little bit inflated if you include Drake May's scramble. Like, they're averaging 9.4 yards per carry, Shine, on Drake May's scrambles so far this year. And if there's a couple of Brissett ones in there too, but they're averaging 9.4 yards on May's scrambles. And on running back runs, though, like I said, 2.1 right guard, 3.7 up the middle, 3.4 to the left guard. So this offensive line is not opening up holes. Even Ramondre Stevenson, before his injury, he had the fifth most yards per contact in the NFL. And that wasn't because he was breaking tackles downfield. It was because he was getting hit at the line constantly. So when we talk about May and his development here, I think the running numbers, because you mentioned he accounted for 95% or whatever it was of their offense. I mean, Stevenson had 10 carries for 16 yards the other day. Like, you
that
can't
just doesn't
have
work.
That, and you just can't rely on Drake May to have 8 carries a game. I think that's way too much. And I know there's scrambles, and some of it is your O-line. Some of it is receivers aren't getting open. But we are talking about a guy that just had his first concussion, could have missed last week's game. He was able to play, but you know, was in jeopardy throughout most of the week. Do we really want to see him keep subjecting himself to that? And I don't blame him for necessarily running, but I wonder, is there a way, and maybe this is an Alex Van Pelt thing, can you design more plays with quick options, with hot routes, with dump-offs? Because, I mean, 8 carries a game, Shime, to me, and I know you love watching May run, but that feels like too much to me.
I couldn't agree more. Like, I want to see him run, and I think he needs to run in certain moments, but I thought there were times Sunday where he did run, and he could have kind of uncorked it. There was one in particular, actually even a sack early in the game there, where I felt like he could have ripped it into a tight window, but like a doable window to a guy like Pop Douglas, who has been reliable. And I think he needs to be willing to trust those guys and take that chance. But I think he's still kind of wavering on that trust, because he has thrown a few good balls that just get dropped. And he's like, well, do I risk getting dropped, or do I just take the 10 yards that they're giving me? Like, if they're just going to play man coverage and turn their backs to me, I'm just going to take the 10 yards, which I understand, and I don't hate. Like, it could be a worse decision. I'd rather you do that than force something into coverage. But I just look at what Liam Cohen did last night with the Buccaneers, and it's like, all right, Kansas City has a really good rushing defense. Like, all right, let's just send Sterling Shepard on a jet sweep. Let's really mix up our run game here. Let's put Rashad White and Bucky Irving on the field at the same time so that we can kind of give them a different look. And yet I feel like I get none of that from Alex Van Pelt. I feel like all we get is the same vanilla concepts over and over again. It's like blast, it's stretch, and then it's simple play action. It's these levels concepts that the spacing looks terrible, and I can't tell half the time if it's the receivers or if it's the design of the play. And so it's just, I feel like Drake is in a situation right now where he almost can't win. It's between the bad play calling, the inability to run the football, and then the trust factor that I don't think has been established with the receivers. I think it's just like, it is just asking for chaos. And that's why you see him running so much.
Yeah, and it's an interesting point, because I feel like this offense, and I know May's a rookie starter, so he's learning things, but they don't use a lot of motion. They use some bunch sets, but not a ton. You mentioned the jet sweep things. Like, it feels like there's not a lot of creativity there beyond just what the base offense is, right?
None.
They're just, right, they're running those base concepts. And even, it feels to me, and I know we've talked about this a little bit, but it keeps happening, that it just doesn't feel like things build on themselves in this offense. Like, they'll run outside zone, and then they'll run power, but then their play action will be off outside zone, which they haven't run as well. And I know that was an issue more earlier in the year. They don't run a lot of effective screens either, and that's something that, you know, for those of us that have watched the Patriots the last 25, 30 years, they've always been a good screen team, especially under Belichick and with Brady and McDaniels and that offense. But even going back to Charlie Weiss, they've always been a great screen team. And I feel like we see minimal screens with this team. So that's something going forward.
And the screens we do see are terrible half the time.
Right, fair point. And I think that's a way, though, to your point, to limit some of these Drake May scrambles is if they just added more either hot routes, screens, just motions, bunch sets. Like, there's a lot of things you can do to get the ball out of Drake May's hands quickly, and it just feels like they're not doing enough of that.
No, I totally agree. I mean, just last night, for example, you saw Liam Coe do it a ton with his running backs.
Rhode Island guy, by the way.
Yep, Rhode Island guy, local guy. Love that. And then Andy Reid has been famous for it over the last decade now, right? You saw in particular last night, DeAndre Hopkins and Mecole Hardman are split left. You have one corner close, one corner playing off, right? So what does he do? Patrick Mahomes just receives a shotgun snap, immediately looks left and throws it to Mecole Hardman as DeAndre Hopkins blocks the up-close guy and just allows the wide receiver to try and make a play. And yet I feel like we don't get any of that. I feel like it's these classic, you know, like slip screens that just get sniffed out half the time because they're so simple and easy to read. And there's no, you know, good bubble screens. There's no just like easy swing routes, easy just slants over the middle of the field for the quarterback to get in a rhythm. And it's just, it feels archaic.
Yeah, it's a, unfortunately, I think, Shyam, it's a good point because it feels archaic. I think you're right. And hopefully it's something they can change moving forward. But Sean, today's a pretty important day, if you weren't aware. There's
yeah,
some important stuff going on. And what I mean is today is the NFL trade deadline, and what we're going to get into next, there was a lot of discussions around a bunch of Patriot players. None of them ended up moving. We're going to get into that. We're going to get into some of maybe a few other moves that we liked out there. But before we do that, it's time to trend with Zach Coe.
Now, here's what's trending on WEEI.
Trending now brought to you by Awaken 180 Weight Loss. Celtics beat the Hawks last night 123-93, the final in Atlanta. Jason Tatum led the way for the Seas with 28 points. Derek White and Peyton Pritchard were right behind him with 21 and 18 respectively. They'll return home for a quick two-game homestand kicking off tomorrow against the Warriors. According to our very own Justin Turpin, Jaylen Brown will remain out for that matchup, continuing to nurse a hip injury. Bruins in action tonight up in Toronto taking on the Maple Leafs. It will be Jeremy Swayman in net for the Bees, and the Bruins' debut of Tyler Johnson after he signed a one-year $775,000 contract with the team yesterday. To make room on the roster, they waived forward Max Jones. Puck drop from Scotiabank Arena in Toronto set for 7 p.m. NFL trade deadline has come and gone, and no moves for the Patriots. Elsewhere around the league, the Commanders acquired corner Marshawn Lattimore from New Orleans. Lions acquired edge rusher Za'Darius Smith from the Browns. In a pair of moves for the Steelers, they acquired edge rusher Preston Smith from the Packers and wide receiver Mike Williams from the Jets. November is Veterans Month, and Awaken 180 is honoring all active duty veterans and spouses with 15% off your entire program, plus the same free support for life all clients receive. Celebrate Veterans Month with 15% off at Awaken180weightloss.com. My name is Zach Coe, and that's what's trending on WEI and WEI.com. More Shyam and Lions coming up after this.
There's sports betting, and then there's Circa Las Vegas, an adults-only sports watching nirvana. Now you can watch up to 19 games at the world's largest sports book on a 78-million-pixel, three-story mega screen. Plus, it's always spectator season at America's largest pool amphitheater, Stadium Swim. Stadium Swim is open 365 days a year and features all sports on an epic 143-foot screen. Book your reservation at CircaLasVegas.com. Circa Las Vegas, this is sports the way it should be.
Come join me, Andrew Filippone.
And me, Patrick Peterson, three-time NFL All-Pro cornerback on First and Pod for premier NFL coverage and conversations.
Our motto on the podcast is every team, every week, and we don't play favorites. Every episode, you get a glimpse of the entire National Football League with First and Pod. Follow and listen to First and Pod on Mondays and Fridays on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
We're back to John Lyons on WEEI.
Back here on WEEI, I'm John Lyons, alongside Chris Schein, and Zach Ho is producing. And we need to get to an important thing that happened today. Now, you may be aware today's an important day. And it's, you know, the presidential election, sure. But, Shime, we know why it's really important today, correct?
Absolutely, John. It was the NFL trade deadline day.
It sure was. And the trade deadline has traditionally been a snooze fest in the NFL. And there were several moves today, no real earth-shattering ones. But I want to start with the moves that weren't made. And Diana Russini of The Athletic had a report that the Patriots received calls on several notable players, Devon Godshaw, Kyle Duggar, Kendrick Bourne, KJ Osborne, and weren't able to make a move on any of those guys. Shime, I want to start with you. Is there any of those guys that you're just shocked is still here, or you kind of understand they're all still here?
I'm actually kind of surprised Devon Godshaw is still here. I felt like he would have had a lot of value out there. I know the Cincinnati Bengals in particular were looking for defensive tackle help, so I felt like a guy like him might have been valuable on the trade market. You might have been able to get something that helps you in the future going forward. But outside of that, I'm not shocked that none of these guys were dealt. I mean, KJ Osborne and Tyquan Thornton, really, was really anyone actually interested in them? I find that hard to believe. They both kind of stink, to be completely honest with you. And then Kyle Duggar, you just signed to a long-term contract. We talked to Tommy Curran on Sunday at the WEEI football Sunday show, me and Mego did, and he even said, he's like, it just doesn't make sense. You signed him this long-term deal in the offseason. Why would you then turn around and trade him when you have him under term? And I think that made perfect sense. I never thought Kyle Duggar was really in risk of getting traded. Logically, it just never made sense. And then, again, I don't know who would want KJ Osborne and Tyquan Thornton.
Yeah, and Kyle Duggar was the one name that really surprised me for the reasons you said.
Sure.
This is a guy that is supposed to be a leader on your defense, be a key part of what you're doing, and especially with Jabril Peppers, though, right? Because now this is your only real experience safety. And
absolutely.
I know we missed last Sunday's game. And long-term, depending on how this Peppers situation goes, your safety tandem over the next 2-3 years could be Duggar and Marte Mapu. So, like, that to me is a guy that you want around, and it's another one of those homegrown players that they re-signed, which, I mean, for years we were saying, wow, they don't have any homegrown players. They aren't re-signing any draft picks. He's finally a guy that they do that for. So I was surprised he was even in any trade discussions. It may have been more teams calling about him as opposed to the Patriots actively shopping him around. So I'm glad to see he's sticking around. That one never really made much sense to me, especially with the Peppers situation. But to be honest, even if that wasn't the case, there's no way I'm moving on from Kyle Duggar.
It would have made more sense to move on from Peppers if he was available than it would be to move on from Kyle Duggar. And then, like you said, with Peppers kind of out of the picture at this point, unsure of what his future is going to look like with this team and in the NFL, like, Kyle Duggar was a guy you had to kind of keep here, especially a guy that you have under contract now for the next few years. It never made sense to move on from him. So to know that it's probably going to be him and some kind of combination of Mapu, Jalen Hawkins, and or insert some young safety that they get in the offseason going forward, that kind of made sense. And with the KJ Osborne and Tyquan Thornton thing, I also thought that if they were actually talking to teams, all teams had to do was offer you a 7th-round pick, and take them. Just get them out of my building. At this point, I would have, like, I hope they kind of, I really do kind of hope they cut KJ Osborne. It's, you need to send a message to this receiver group one way or another, and cutting the one veteran receiver outside of Kendrick Bourne that you have seems like the right move. Like, he's useless. He doesn't help you in any aspect of the game. I would rather give those reps anytime he's on the field to Javon Baker so that he actually, like, we can find out if he was worth a fourth round pick or not, and we move forward. Like, he is useless and irrelevant on this roster, and I kind of still am shocked that he's here at all.
Yeah, and I was surprised that this receiver room didn't have some sort of transaction, whether it was Osborne, Thornton, or Kendrick Bourne. And look, none of those guys are going to get you more than a seventh-round pick, maybe a sixth if you're lucky and some team gets crazy. So we're not talking about a big trade here. But I think,
then again, Jonathan Mingo fetched a fourth today, so I guess anything's possible.
Yeah, I guess you're right on that, yeah. But this receiver group, to me, is probably the least productive receiver group they've had since 2006.
Oh, yeah, it's not even close.
Yeah, difference is that year, you know, you had number 12, so that kind of helped things out, and you had a great defense and great coaching
staff. Rashay Caldwell was better than anything you have on this roster.
Yeah, I'd add Jabbar Gaffney probably was too, right?
Probably
so this is the worst receiver group, the least productive group you've had since then, and they weren't going to be able to do anything today that was going to overhaul that. Like, I'm glad, Scheim, they weren't out there buying a lot and going crazy, because the way their draft position, and I know it's November 5th and we hate talking about draft stuff already. We used to talk about playoff seedings this time of year, but I mean, there's a lot of teams right now, 2-7 or 2-6 with a bye, or right on that edge of they could be the second pick or third pick, or they could be the 10th pick. And I think for the Patriots, it was smart to not go out and really be buyers, because what if you trade your second round pick for a really good receiver, but then that ends up being 33 or 34 overall, and you could have traded it for an even better player come the offseason, or picked a guy you like. So I'm glad they weren't buyers, but I am surprised there wasn't some sort of transaction with this receiver room.
Yeah, see, I disagree. I would have been fine with them being buyers. I get it. You know, having pick 34 or 35 is nice, but if I can get an established player that is still young and I'm going to be able to have under contract, like, that to me is worth it. Like, if I'm getting a legitimate receiver, and not that this guy was available and because he's injured, like a guy like a T. Higgins or something, I'm absolutely willing to give up a second round pick. And I, even for a guy like Amari Cooper, I would have been willing. A guy like T. Higgins, like any of those guys, I would have been more than happy to give up a draft pick. I don't think you, like, I think people sometimes overrate draft picks a little bit. And especially if you are picking one or two, you're probably trading out of there and getting a bunch of assets anyways. So if that's your plan, right, if you do finish horribly the rest of the season and you finish in the top three, you don't need a quarterback. You can trade back and acquire assets anyways. So I felt like a second or third round pick at the deadline was very expendable for you. So I was kind of upset. I would have liked to see them try, or at least heard reports of them trying to go after somebody that was a little bit of a bigger name, and yet we got nothing.
Yeah, to me, if I'm going to trade that second round pick the Patriots have, and I'm under the assumption it's going to be one of the first five picks of the second round, it's going to be for a more than an Amari Cooper type player. Like, it's going to be for a DK Metcalf, or if the 49ers, if Ayuk was still healthy and they wanted to move on from
Debo Samuel. Oh, God, what I would give for DK Metcalf.
Yeah, right. But I think, to me, that's like pick 33, 34, 35. That's where you start to get into those conversations. Like, I don't want to trade a pick like that at the deadline and get a guy, and sure, Amari Cooper, just to throw it, like, he's a fine player, he's pretty good, but he's not on the level of those other guys. And that, to me, a high second round pick, you can get a really valuable player for a pick like that. So unless one of those guys was available, I'm fine with them not trading their second round pick, even their third round pick at that, because again, we don't know exactly how it's going to shake out. I was kind of surprised, though, Scheim. Jonathan Jones, I thought he was their most tradable asset off the roster, because they weren't going to trade Christian Gonzalez or Keon White, I don't think Kyle Duggar they were really ever going to trade. Obviously, they're not going to trade Drake May. We know that. So I think of the guys they could actually trade, Jonathan Jones was probably the most attractive piece. He's a guy that can play slot corner. When he did that, he was one of the best slot corners in the NFL. We all remember what he did against Tyreek Hill in the 2018 AFC Championship game. He can also play outside corner pretty well. Maybe not as good as in the slot, but still pretty well. He's even gotten some reps at safety. I was surprised the contending team didn't look at him and say, that's a guy we'll give up, you know, maybe a fourth, and if the Patriots are lucky, a late third, because they can plug him in multiple spots in their defensive backfield and maybe make a run in the playoffs with him.
Yeah, I get it. I think they would have had to been kind of blown away by an offer just because you don't have a lot of bodies at corner right now. Like, it's just, I mean, you would have gone from starting Jonathan Jones to starting either Marcellus Dial or Marco Wilson. I guess that to me does...
Just for the record, I saw those guys at training camp, and they are not Jonathan Jones.
No, they're not even close. And so, and I feel like Jonathan Jones is also one of the few veteran voices you have in this locker room. So I felt like dealing Jonathan Jones wasn't probably in the cards. I think they'd like to keep him. He's a great guy to be helping Christian Gonzalez along in this process as well. And again, you just don't have the bodies on defense. Your defense is already bad enough. I feel like getting rid of Jonathan Jones would have made things exponentially worse.
And the thing about it, to me, the two best defensive plays the Patriots have made all year was Kyle Duggar's forced fumble on the goal line in week one in Cincinnati and Jonathan Jones' fourth down stop in that same game. So, like, those are, again, I was surprised he wasn't moved, but I am happy to see him here because I think Jonathan Jones, to your point, that's a valuable player. I mean, he doesn't have any interceptions this year, but his PFF coverage grade is still a 70, which is pretty good. He's, I think, the only guy on your roster healthy right now that's won multiple Super Bowls here, the other one being David Andrews, who's injured. Dietrich Wise has won. There might be another player or two that have won. But he's really in a very small group of guys that knows what it's like to win at a high level in New England. And I think that is valuable for, you mentioned Christian Gonzalez, but I would even argue for really all the young defensive players and maybe even some
so
of the,
many.
Yeah, and even some of the young offensive players, right? Jalen Polk lines up across from him in practice, and of course Polk has struggled quite a bit this year, and he sees, all right, that's a guy that's won multiple Super Bowls. He knows what it takes. Maybe that's a guy I can try to emulate some of the ways he prepares, some of the ways he practices. So I think a guy like Jonathan Jones, again, that's why I thought he would be so attractive to a contending team, because he's still playing well. He's a really fast runner, which of course you need in the postseason to get some of these great, great receivers you're going to see in the postseason, and he's won multiple Super Bowls. So I thought he would have been attractive to a contender, but I am glad he's staying around really just as much for the locker room preparation type stuff as is his actual play on the field.
Yeah, I guess logically to me, I guess it doesn't necessarily make sense to move him to on that expiring contract. You're probably just going to get a comp pick for him anyways when he signs with the team in the offseason that probably won't be here. So it was just a matter of getting the pick earlier rather than later, to be completely honest. Yeah. And so having him here
is interesting because if they spend a lot of money in free agency, maybe the comp pick doesn't happen.
Sure.
So it will be interesting to see what their strategy. I mean, is this an early indication of they want to re-sign him and keep him around for several more years? Or are they maybe not going to spend as aggressively in free agency so they will get some of those?
God, I hope that's not the case.
Trust me, I hope not too, man. But is it a subtle indication of their strategy? It's tough to tell because we really don't have a lot of information on Elliot Wolf. I mean, he came in the spring. He runs their draft, then gets the official executive vice president of player personnel title after. And a lot of what he did was re-sign the Patriots' own players. I mean, if you look at the free agency,
that's all of what he did almost.
Yeah, I mean, look at the free agency brought in. I mean, Okorafor's not with the team anymore. Leverett's not around, right? KJ Osborne is kind of, at best, he's an ancillary piece, but he's really not part of what you're trying to do here moving forward. So it's basically been re-sign your own guys and draft Drake May and Polk and those other in the draft. So we don't really know what his strategy, which is he going to be a guy like the Green Bay Packers, where he came from originally, that they don't do a lot of free agency stuff, they're not huge in the trade market, or is it going to be more the Patriots, where in the last few years they've been more active in the free agent market, and even going back further, they would target specific players? I don't know. Is this part of his strategy? Is this just how it worked out today?
Not.
I think that's something to monitor going forward.
Yeah, I really hope not. I really hope it's not this Green Bay strategy, because in order for that Green Bay strategy to work, you actually have to hit on your draft picks.
And it's going to take like 3 more years.
Yeah, and I think you kind of lucked into, I think they lucked into Drake May. He was just the best quarterback available and they were picking at 3. I think it was the right pick because I love Drake May, but like I think they kind of lucked into it. Caden Wallace is a third round pick what limited time we've seen him on the field hasn't been great. Again, a rookie, but still the limited time we've seen him, not been good. Jalen Polk has struggled mightily in his rookie year so far. So your first three-round picks have all struggled. Javon Baker can barely get on the field. There's your fourth-round pick. So if you're not nailing all of these picks, you cannot build it the way Green Bay did. Well, and so I really hope that they're willing to spend in free agency a little bit. Otherwise, this rebuild is going to take far longer than it should. And you have the quarterback, so your window's kind of opening up now. If you are trying to do what the Red Sox have been doing and just like waiting and biding your time and hoping these young guys just kind of pan out, you are going to waste the golden years of Drake May here, and then you're going to have to pay him out the wazoo, and then you're going to have nobody, and it's going to be a nightmare.
Yeah, it's a good point, because that Drake May rookie contract, that's 5 years, and you're in year one, obviously, now. So you want to start becoming a good team really by next year, if not the year after at the latest, because before you know it, he's going to be a guy that requires, if he's good, like we hope he is, and he's looked pretty good so far, a major contract extension, which is going to eat up a huge part of your cap. I mean, look at what San Francisco was able to do with Brock Purdy not making any money. I mean, they add all these guys, they re-sign all these
like
guys.
Crazy.
Exactly. They went nuts. And eventually,
look at what Houston's doing. It's
look
the
at
same
what Houston,
thing.
Another great point, right? Look at what they're doing. So that's what the Patriots could be able to do if they decide to go that route. I think that's the smart route to go. We saw the Rams do it and get to a Super Bowl with Jared Goff several years ago. So, I mean, I think that's the way to go. But I wonder, is this trade deadline some sort of subtle indication that they don't want to be active in the trade market, or they don't want to spend a lot, or is it just they didn't want to trade Kyle Duggar, they didn't want to give up a second or third round pick that could be at the top of one of those rounds, which again, I'm okay with that, but it's just with Elliott Wolf, it's such a limited track record, we don't really have much to judge right now. I mean, this is his first ever trade deadline. They didn't really make any trades or any really major moves at all in the offseason, so
And all the moves he did make have stunk. Any move he made in the margin has not been good.
Yeah, I can't think of... I mean like
two of your biggest offseason signings aren't on the team anymore.
Osborne hasn't done anything. I mean, unless I'm missing somebody, I can't think of a piece they brought in that's made a legit impact.
The closest thing to a legit impact would be Antonio Gibson and Austin Hooper.
And even that's been limited. I mean,
and
I feel like Gibson had that 45-yard run against Seattle, and other than that, he's barely done anything.
Yeah, outside of that, like, they have not brought in anybody new that has had any impact whatsoever. It has been only Antonio Gibson and Austin Hooper, and they've both been extremely minute additions to the team.
And Shyam, today was the trade deadline around the league. We're going to get to, later on, maybe a move or two or more than that we liked. But first, the Bruins face off in about 20-25 minutes against Toronto.
Boy.
They had a very interesting weekend to me. They lose 8-2 on Thursday night, win back-to-back games Saturday, Sunday, but bench their best player.
Rumors of Jim Montgomery being on the hot seat floating around.
Yeah, so I want to get into that coming up next here on WEEI.
We're back to John Lyons on WEEI.
That was David Pastrnak talking about one of the most surprising events of the weekend to me, and that was him getting benched. I'm John Lyons alongside Chris Schein. And Schein, this has been a really weird week for the Boston Bruins. I mean, they have that 8-2 loss Thursday night where it just, I thought there was a possibility Jim Montgomery could have lost his job on Friday. That's how bad things looked and how bad they're at.
I think a lot of people agree with you.
Yeah, and they win two games over the weekend to get themselves to 6-6-1, so they're still below 500 if you include that overtime loss. But to me, I mean, Pastrnak, 14 minutes and 11 seconds of ice time through two periods, had seven shots, which led the Bruins, did have the two giveaways, including that one late in the second period that resulted in a shorthanded scoring chance for Seattle. But I have to admit, I was surprised when the Bruins came out for the third period and he just remained on the bench.
Yeah, it was very surprising. I had seen Scott McLaughlin, our guy here at WEEI, tweet about it. And then all Montgomery commented on was it was a coaching decision after the game. That's all he said about it and would say nothing more. And so it seemed odd that he would be on the bench. It felt like it had to be injury related or something, but it doesn't seem like it was. It seems like it was for that bad turnover that he's trying to take accountability for. And I don't know. Earlier in the season, Montgomery said he was looking for more from certain players, especially on offense. And clearly, it seems like David Pastrnak is at the top of Monty's list.
Yeah, and that's interesting to me because it feels like for the first couple of years, Pastrnak's been a guy that Montgomery leaned on quite a bit. Of course, he did call him out after Game 6 against the Leafs last year. Pastrnak scores the game winner.
And then he immediately responded.
Right, he scores the game winner in Game 7. So we'll see tonight against the Leafs, does Pastrnak bounce back and have a great game? But I was still, like, here's the thing. Pastrnak, he had the two giveaways. He does have issues with turnovers. But a lot of the guys that have a lot of turnovers or giveaways, as they're called, are guys that are great players and great scorers, and because they have the puck a lot. Like last year, if you look at the list of guys who were top 10 in giveaways, Pastrnak was on that list, but so was Nikita Kucherov, Leon Draisaitl, Connor McDavid, Nathan MacKinnon. Like, these guys all had a lot of turnovers too, but they're elite scorers and elite players. And it's been an interesting shift from Montgomery, and I really go back to that Game 6 against the Leafs, because he calls out Pastrnak. Then you see this year he's yelling at Marchand behind the bench early in the season. Now he benches Pastrnak. I mean, Shime, do you sense this is he worried about his job? Is he shifting how he's approaching things because the roster's a little bit different? Because this feels like, going back to that Game 6, this feels like a legitimate shift from what we had before.
Very much so. It feels almost like, and I'm curious your thoughts, it feels like kind of what Bill Belichick used to do, right? Like on Low Lights Monday, where he would just rip Tom Brady because Tom Brady's the best player, and then everybody would almost just fall in line like, oh man, if you can rip Tom Brady, you're going to rip me. And like, I need to kind of play my best here, because I feel like this season for the Bruins, the turnover issues aren't like, yeah, Pastrnak and Marchand have had some turnovers, but like, primarily they've been on a lot of other guys on this team, especially the defense, who has been atrocious at times this year, and yet Monty's not laying into them. So is this just a thing where Monty's like, all right, these two are my veteran guys who I know can take it. I have to set an example somehow. And so he's coming after these two guys in particular, knowing full well that they're prepared to kind of be prepared for Monty's criticism, right? Like even Marchand said in a post-game interview, like, I'd be more worried if he wasn't doing that for me. And so maybe it's just that, like, maybe this is Monty's way of trying to get a hold of this team.
You know what? It's interesting because the Bruins, to your point, they're fifth in the NHL in giveaways. They have 198. So right near the, and when I say fifth, I mean fifth worst. So they're near the bottom of the league. And I guess if there's two guys that you can use to send a message, Marchand and Pastrnak would be at the top of that list, right? Marchand,
yeah,
has won a Stanley Cup. He's been to three. Pastrnak has been to one Stanley Cup, and he's been the best player on your team for at least the last 3 years now, maybe the last 4 or 5 years, depending on how you want to rate guys. But when he tried to do it with Marchand, it really didn't go that well. I mean, the Bruins followed that up by not playing well, and then, of course, they had that 8-2 debacle to Carolina. So maybe with the Pastrnak thing, I mean, they did win both games over the weekend. Obviously, the first one wasn't really part of this benching situation, but does it light a fire under some other guys where, oh, wow, if he'll sit Pastrnak down, then maybe I need to step my game up? Because, again, 198 giveaways, you mentioned it, so many of them have been either in the defensive end or right near the defensive end, led to chances, led to goals, ultimately led to losses. I mean, this is a team that 2 years ago had the best start in the NHL through the first month, month and a half, and obviously they ended up with the best record. Last year they started out hot. This year, I mean, 6-6-1. 13 games, you're 6-6-1. It's a lot different, at least that I thought it was going to be, and I think than the Bruins themselves thought it was going to be.
Yeah, it's absolutely different than what I think anybody thought that this was going to be, but I think they're still finding their identity. They just, a lot of this has been they don't know what they want to be, and in result, they've turned the ball over a ton, and Monty is trying to figure out how to handle this team. Like, he knew how to handle the last two teams, especially the one with Bergeron. He outright said, he's like, half the time I don't need to coach these guys because Bergeron just does it for me. And then last year, I think, was still a lot of leftover effect from that Bergeron-Krejci leadership core, and you kind of saw it play out throughout the season, and it was very similar to the season before. They dominated in the regular season, except last year they actually won a playoff round and moved forward. And so This year, though, they're just another year removed from that that kind of leadership cloud. They brought in a ton of new players. I mean, you look at Zadorov, you look at Lindholm, and then you add in...
Even if you want to talk about Swayman re-signing, I know he wasn't a new player, but you give a guy 8 years, $8.25 million a year, all of a sudden that elevates his status, elevates his profile in the locker room. So I think that's something to kind
Morgan
of be mindful
Geeky of. Geeky wasn't here for the Bergeron stuff. A lot of those young defensemen, your guys like...
Even Mason Lowry, he was in the organization with Bergeron, but he wasn't really part of that group.
No, Andrew Peak was never a part of that group. Yeah. Parker Wotherspoon was never really a part of that group. Like, really, it was only McAvoy and Carlo. And so it's, I think you're seeing the shift and this team trying to identify exactly who the leaders are and Monty trying to fill some of that gap by being a little bit more hard on the players than he had been previously. I mean, you know, Mike Milbury calls him Mr. Rogers. And he has felt much more like Bruce Cassidy through 13 games this season than he has the last 2 years.
Yeah, it's been a definite shift. And it was nice to see the Bruins, at least this weekend, they started both games well. They led the Flyers 1-0 early in that game. They were kind of all over Seattle parts early in that game. And even more importantly, you got shutouts from both goalies. And I know the Flyers are bad.
Awesome.
So, yeah, the Korpisalo shutout. But it was still a shutout. And this is an area, too. You invested a lot in that goaltending position if you're the Boston Bruins, right? Korpisalo was part of the Ullmark trade. Then I just mentioned the contract they gave Swayman. If they're going to be a team that can go deeper in the playoffs this year, which I still think that potential is there, even though they've played poorly most of this year, the goaltending is going to have to be a huge part of it. At least this weekend it was.
Yeah, it absolutely was. And even though you shut out that Philadelphia team that's not good, they shut you out two nights prior or three nights prior, whatever it was. And so, like, that's an important bounce back. I think those two wins over the weekend mean a lot. I think it I felt like, and I hate to do this to my guy because he's Scoops Keefe, but I felt like the Monty on the hot seat scoop was a little bit just kind of to try and incite the team a little bit and incite the player and incite the coach. Not necessarily that he was at risk of losing his job this early in the season. I just, for me, the way the Bruins have done business in the past, right? Claude had such a long leash, and same with Cassidy had such a long leash. And with the success Monty has had in the regular season the last 2 years and winning a playoff series last year, I felt like pulling the trigger after that 8-2 Carolina loss would have been extremely overreactionary, which is not what the Bruins have been in the last decade to two decades. And so I felt like that might have been a little bit smoke and mirrorsy. And I think hopefully now you win back to backs against Philadelphia and Seattle. Maybe you sneak one away from the Maple Leafs tonight. And then it's like, all right, we've won three in a row. We're kind of cooking here a little bit. And then all those Monty rumors go away.
You're listening to Lions and Chime on WEEI. We got plenty left still in the program. Celtics play the Warriors tomorrow night. Little more Bruins NFL trade deadline. Of course, even though KJ's not here, Just a Jag will still be here at 7:45. So we got plenty of that and more coming up on WEEI.
There's sports betting, and then there's Circa Las Vegas, an adults-only sports watching nirvana. Now you can watch up to 19 games at the world's largest sportsbook on a 78-million-pixel, three-story mega screen. Plus, it's always spectator season at America's largest pool amphitheater, Stadium Swim. Stadium Swim is open 365 days a year and features all sports on an epic 143-foot screen. Book your reservation at CircaLasVegas.com. Circa Las Vegas, this is sports the way it should be.
Come join me, Andrew Filippone.
And me, Patrick Peterson, three-time NFL All-Pro cornerback on First and Pod for premier NFL coverage and conversations.
Our motto on the podcast is every team, every week, and we don't play favorites. Every episode, you get a glimpse of the entire National Football League with First and Pod. Follow and listen to First and Pod on Mondays and Fridays on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.